Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who talks about his campaign to increase the federal minimum wage. Paul Corbett Brown and Elise Keaton of the Keeper of the Mountains Foundation, who describe the destruction wrought by mountaintop removal coal mining in West Virginia and across Appalachia. And investigative journalist Robert Perry, who discusses lingering questions about the conduct of newly named Pope Francis's conduct during Argentina's brutal military dictatorship. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the Queen District of eastern Uganda, local women fit into two camps, circumcised and uncircumcised. The dividing line is not only clinical, but social and demographic. Female circumcision is more commonly known as female genital mutilation, or FGM. Today, 140 million women and girls have been subject to female genital mutilation, mostly in Africa and the Middle East. In recent years, campaigners have made real progress in blocking FGM and discouraging girls from undergoing the procedure. Last December, the United Nations General Assembly unanimously passed a resolution condemning FGM, charging that the traditional practice was irreparable, irreversible abuse on girls and women. In the past, campaigns against female genital mutilation in Africa and the Middle East were hobbled by accusations that the promoters were agents of colonialism, injecting Western secular values into developing nations. Now the momentum has shifted as local FGM activists are taking the lead in the movement for change. Bisphenol A, or BPA, and phthalates are endocrine disruptors, which interfere with the human hormone system and are linked to human diseases such as asthma, obesity, heart disease, diabetes, and breast cancer. Mother Jones Magazine reports it can be extremely difficult to avoid exposure to BPA and phthalates because they are put into many plastic products widely used in food processing. Thus far, the Food and Drug Administration has only taken limited steps, such as banning the use of BPA in baby bottles. A research team from the University of Washington's Seattle Children's Research Institute tested two groups of families for BPA and related exposure. The first group ate organic and local food from a catering company that avoided using plastics in preparation of food. The second group was given fact sheets on the best practices to prepare food to reduce exposure to BPA. Surprisingly, the group that ate the organic and local food had high levels of BPA and phthalates, while the levels in the group with the fact sheets remained stable. Lead Seattle researcher Sheila Satyanarayana said the trial revealed that milk from a local farm carried high levels of the chemical because cow's milk from many farms is routinely sent through soft plastic tubes. The study is far from conclusive, but it does point to the role food producers play in unknowingly contaminating the food supply. Since the mass shooting at Newtown, Connecticut's Sandy Hook Elementary School in mid-December, the Obama administration has released $150 million to assist school districts to hire 1,000 on-campus police or counselors. A growing number of state legislatures are now debating how to shift money around to put more cops in schools. According to the Center for Public Integrity, the National Rifle Association is pushing to allow teachers and/or other staff to bring licensed guns into schools to protect students from a potential future attack. At the same time, there's a counter-movement by civil rights activists and youth workers to move police out of school buildings and prevent law enforcement from being involved in school disciplinary issues. Some activists increasingly worry about the growing presence of police officers in schools that has been on the rise since the 1999 Columbine, Colorado mass school shooting. In suburban Atlanta, Chief Juvenile Court Judge Stephen Teske saw school infractions increase from one-third of his caseload in 1999 to over 90% 5 years later. The ACLU recently sued the New York City Police Department for systematically violating students' rights, using excessive force, restraining young people with handcuffs, and arresting youths for minor infractions like drawing on a desk. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
On a bright winter morning, citizen activist and four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader gathered with 12 other people in front of the Torrington, Connecticut Walmart store. The Connecticut native, who grew up in nearby Winsted, organized the Walmart picket to kick off a national grassroots campaign to demand an increase in the federal minimum wage. Although President Obama, during his February 12th State of the Union address, called for a rise in the minimum wage from the current $7.25 to $9 an hour indexed to inflation, Nader says that moving to a $10.50 minimum wage should be the goal in order to catch up with the actual value of the minimum wage in 1968. Nader points out that while Walmart CEO Mike Duke makes about $11,000 an hour, 30 million American workers who earn the minimum wage are losing ground, a symptom of growing income inequality across the nation. According to the AFL-CIO, top executives at America's largest corporations made 42 times the pay of the average worker in 1980, but now CEOs are earning 343 times the average worker's wage. On March 15th, Republicans who control the House of Representatives unanimously voted down an amendment to legislation that would have raised the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. Adding to the debate, newly elected Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, citing a 2012 study, asserted that if wages were tied to productivity, the minimum wage today would be $22 an hour. Your reporter spoke with Ralph Nader about his campaign to raise the minimum wage and the pros and cons cited by supporters and opponents in the national debate on the proposal.
Well, you know, Obama put forth $9 an hour by 2015. George Miller, the congressman, and Senator Harkin, they've put forth $10.10 by 2016. I mean, it's like people can wait. I mean, these companies have been getting windfalls year after year, shrinking real wage, and now they want to make people who serve us, people who take care of our children, take care of our ailing grandparents, who clean up after us, who grow our food, they want them to wait until 2016. Now, we got to, in effect, get moving. Now, we have exact materials you need to put the pressure on Congress. It's all in Congress or your state legislature. Put the pressure. Just go to timeforaraise.org. That's a really easy one to remember, timeforaraise.org. And it's got, you know, form statements and form letters if you want. And you spice it up. Give it your own distinctive language. And let's go.
Ralph, you know, in our media system, we constantly hear the voices of opposition to a rise in the minimum wage. And they say that an increase in the minimum wage will hurt job creators, slow down the economy, trigger layoffs or a freeze in hiring, penalize teenagers and entry-level workers. I know you've got a response for that.
They got some nerve. They certainly don't talk about laying off workers because they're paying their bosses tens of millions of dollars a year. Major economic studies show, one, there is not overall job loss. There's a net job increase. Why wouldn't there be? Tens of billions of dollars in additional money be spent in the marketplace, in stores for the necessities of life of these working poor in America, and that's going to create jobs overall. So it is a job increase. It's an economic stimulus without a tax increase. There'll be less reliance on government relief programs because people will be able to earn more money. Walmart actually has a advisory service showing its underpaid workers how they can get earned income tax credit, how they can get food stamps, how they can get all kinds of relief. Can you imagine the nerve? So if they get more wages, there's less pressure on those programs. And finally, the more you get paid, the more you put into Social Security and Medicare. So it's a win all over. All around. And that's what Costco's CEO, I talked to him the other day, and he was very clear. He said, I believe in good wages. We have less employee turnover. We have happier employers. We have more productive employees. And we start them at $11.50 an hour, plus benefits. And that's a big box store. Now, a lot of people don't know this. Almost two-thirds of low-income workers are employed by 50 large corporations whose brand names we know, Burger King and Kmart and Walmart and so on, McDonald's. And the average CEO pay of those companies, the boss, over $10 million a year. Now, there are small businesses, but small business is defined by the federal government as up to 500 employees. That's some small business, Scott. So basically, what we're seeing here is no one will be able to use the minimum wage as a competitive thing because all businesses, all employers will have to raise it. Some workers in some real small businesses may be laid off, but some of these workers who may be laid off will just go and get some of the extra jobs that are being produced because of more sales. I mean, Henry Ford had that figured out in 1914 when he doubled the wage of his auto workers from $2.50 to $5, and he said, hey, I want more customers. We got to pay them more if we're going to have customers for our cars.
Ralph, before we say goodnight, what are you doing to connect with different groups all around the country to push forward this campaign to pressure Congress for an increase in the minimum wage?
Well, we want to get the labor unions moving. The AFL-CIO has been sitting on its duff, hardly doing anything. They've got the money to put some good TV and radio ads on. Look what they do during the campaign for the Democrats, tens of millions of dollars. So SEIU, AFL-CIO, United Auto Workers, and so on, they ought to do that. And they ought to get their locals filling those town meetings in April, and there is a recess, of course, in May, and there's a big congressional recess in August, the whole month. So there's plenty of opportunity to fill those seats at these town meetings.
That was Ralph Nader, consumer advocate, citizen activist, and four-time independent presidential candidate. His latest book is titled The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future. Find more information on Nader's minimum wage campaign on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The fight to end mountaintop removal coal mining in central Appalachia is a part of the bigger campaign to end coal extraction altogether, as that is the most polluting fossil fuel, both in terms of greenhouse gases and in its devastating health and environmental impacts. In the past decade, coal has dropped from providing 50% of the electricity used in the U.S. to a little over 35%, mostly replaced by natural gas. Renewable power sources also claim a small but growing share of energy production. Still, blowing the tops off mountain ridges to get at the coal seams beneath and dropping the rocks and earth and other debris into mountain streams below continues unabated, mainly in West Virginia. The mining method accounts for about 60 million tons of the total 150 million tons of coal produced annually in West Virginia each year. Two activists with the Keeper of the Mountains Foundation toured Connecticut recently, speaking at area colleges and other venues. The foundation was established by Larry Gibson, whose ancestral home on Caford Mountain is surrounded by an enormous mountaintop removal operation that created a moonscape destroying virtually all the native flora and fauna. Mountaintop removal has been shown to contaminate air and water and increase the incidence of several serious illnesses. Elise Keaton is an attorney and fundraising director of Keeper of the Mountains Foundation, and Paul Corbett Brown is a board member and photographer with the group who built a solar home off the grid to demonstrate that people in West Virginia don't have to depend on coal. The pair spoke about mountaintop removal coal mining at Quinnipiac University Law School on March 18th. What follows is an excerpt of their talk.
I went down there, and there, people in these communities told me what mountaintop removal was doing to their homes. They told me how every day the houses would tremble on the foundations from the explosions. They told me how every day you could wipe the coal dust off of everything inside their house. They told me how their wells were going dry, or they were getting water now that was bright red or black or gray. They told me how they were harassed by the coal companies. Because when the coal companies wanted to expand a mining operation, they would come in and ask you to sell your home. And if you say, no, I don't want to sell, they would harass you until you did. People always talk about Appalachia as being the greatest coal region. It's the best coal. It's the best coal. Guess what? Appalachia used to be the source of the best drinking water for the entire eastern seaboard of the United States. That's what we really made the best, was drinking water. Now, three-fourths of the water in West Virginia is compromised beyond any reasonable use, including not just eating out of it, not just drinking it. You're not even supposed to swim in it. It's that bad. And guess what? 2 weeks ago, the West Virginia legislature, the House part of our legislature, passed unanimously House Bill 2579, which said, we think the EPA is full of crap. We can put more selenium in the water than this. It's okay. Go ahead. Put more selenium in the water.
Unanimously.
Unanimously. Not a single dissenting vote. No abstentions. Everyone voted for more selenium in our water, even though 20-some peer-reviewed scientific studies in the last few years have proven beyond any shadow of a doubt that the water quality and the soil quality and the air quality as a result of this mining is causing record numbers of cancer, birth defects, heart attacks, liver disease, lung disease, kidney disease, including genetic mutations in the aquatic wildlife downstream from these mines. The fascinating thing about coal production, and one of the big arguments you're going to hear, is that, well, this is job creation. But it's not job creation. When my dad was a union coal miner, there were 150,000 men mining, mostly men, mining coal 30 years ago. Now, at this point in history, they're mining the same tons every year, but with 10,000 or 12,000 miners. Same amount of tons, about average 150 million tons a year in West Virginia. About 87 or so million of those tons comes from underground mines. The other comes from mountaintop removal mines. Start doing the math and you think, well, wait a minute. If we've reduced our need for coal by 15% of our nation's electric supplies, why are they still mining that much coal? Little by little, we build this social will, and we encourage people just like you, and you join us. And many fibers makes the rope, and we move forward a step, a step, a step until we do these things. We create one house off the grid, then a small community off the grid, then a whole town off the grid, and we just keep educating and drawing people in about what's right about sustainable energy and what's really not right at all about fossil fuels. But it's exciting working with people and getting people involved and getting people motivated. Last Friday, we had a huge rally at the Capitol that said no more MTR, no more fracking. And all of these folks came from colleges and universities from all over the place, and they all came together. And I tell you, it was unreal because they marched through the entire Capitol building singing and chanting and just full of energy and passion.
It's a strange sight in West Virginia, actually.
It is.
And what's interesting about this rally, it was the first time that the folks who were really trying to expand this and move away from coal and fossil fuels, those folks outnumbered the coal miners who went out to protest against us. And that's because we joined forces with the anti-fracking folks. It was anti-mountaintop removal protesters and anti-fracking. And this is really a critical point in this movement now. You know, we have Idle No More. We have the XL pipeline, we have the tar sands protests, we have the fracking protests, we have mountaintop removal. There are a lot of individual movements around this country that are all about the same thing, and that is preserving our communities, you know, and moving away from extraction. I hosted a tour up on Kayford that morning. I couldn't go to the rally, but all of those students came up to Kayford that afternoon after their rally, and they were so excited. Nobody got arrested. Great day, no protest. I mean, you saw those pictures circling through of cops with their knees and feet on the throats of people who are begging for clean water and clean air.
Now, that was at the governor's office just a few years ago.
You know, I mean, that's really where we are here. We're fighting for our lives, and the state police are aligned with the coal companies, who are aligned with the courts, who are aligned with the legislature. And it's really going to take all of us around this country coming together and just saying we're not going to take it anymore. We're not standing up for it anymore. That's my mantra. When I go talk to legislators, I say, you know, you don't understand. My generation, we're done with coal. We're moving towards solar and wind. And if you're not there with us, we've got no place for you in the state house.
That was Elise Keaton and Paul Corbett Brown of the Keeper of the Mountains Foundation. Find more information on groups opposing mountaintop removal coal mining by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. With the retirement of Pope Benedict and the recent election of Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio as the Catholic Church's first Latin American and Jesuit pope, disturbing questions have been raised about the new pontiff's conduct during the reign of Argentina's brutal military dictatorship from 1976 to 1983. As part of Argentina's Catholic hierarchy at the time, Father Bergoglio reportedly remained silent about the military junta's repression of suspected leftists and dissidents that resulted in an estimated 30,000 deaths through torture, execution, and disappearance. Although there are conflicting reports about his conduct, human rights activists have accused Bergoglio of being complicit in the military's kidnapping of two Jesuit priests who work with the poor in a Buenos Aires slum during Argentina's dirty war. The two priests expelled from the Jesuit order by Pope Francis were later arrested, tortured, and imprisoned for 5 months before being released. Accounts of the abduction by one of the priests who has since died and comments by a family member cast doubt on denials of complicity by Francis and the Vatican statement that accusations against the new pope are defamatory. Throughout the Cold War years, the U.S. government through the CIA supported many of Latin America's military governments. Both Washington and some sectors of the Catholic Church often accepted the military's atrocities based on their mutual opposition to social movements labeled as communist. But the Catholic Church was itself divided at the time, as many priests and nuns, identifying with liberation theology, sided with these movements that advocated for the region's poor majority. Your reporter spoke with investigative journalist Robert Perry, editor with ConsortiumNews.com, who discusses the lingering questions about the conduct of Pope Francis during Argentina's brutal military dictatorship.
Essentially, what we know is that he never denounced in any clear or public way what was going on. He sort of kept to himself. Some people say he actually collaborated with the right-wing military. Others say he used his influence privately to try to save a few people here and there. But what is known is that he never put himself in harm's way. He never denounced what was going on. And in that, he was not dissimilar to other elements of the Argentine Catholic hierarchy. And one could argue that he was not that dissimilar from what was going on at the Vatican, where Pope John Paul II was pretty much on board with much of this, very much denouncing liberation theology, even as priests and nuns were being brutally targeted, killed. Nuns often were raped first before they were killed, as happened to four American churchwomen in El Salvador in 1980. So that was the ugly reality. And the question for Father Bergoglio, and now Pope Francis, was at that moment of truth, what did you do? Did you try to stop this in any meaningful way, or did you just watch out for your career within the Catholic hierarchy, and which obviously worked out quite well for him? He ended up getting the top job.
One of the things that's come up in the history of Father Bergoglio at the time, there's a case of two priests who were working in the slums in Argentina who may have been branded as liberation theologists. Father Bergoglio at the time, head of the Jesuit order in Argentina, basically purged these two priests from his order. And not too long after that, they were arrested and tortured in prison for many months. What do we know about the silence of Father Bergoglio or his reported behind-the-scenes intervention on behalf of these two priests? The priests have written some things that really cast Father Bergoglio at the time in a bad light.
Right. The priests, they did survive, which I guess is something, and most of the people that went through that process in Argentina were killed. But they were tortured over about 5 months and then were dumped on the street half-naked and eventually were able to find their way back. But they were quite deeply scarred by this experience. Initially, they did blame Father Bergoglio for essentially leaving them out in the open to be targeted by the death squads and by the military. Subsequently, Father Bergoglio has told some of his supporters that he did intervene after they were taken and urged the military not to kill them. It's hard to know what the total truth is on something like this, but I would say the point that is most obvious is that, first of all, he did participate in this effort to demonize the liberation theologists, putting some of his own people in harm's way, like these two priests. And he did not join in the protests. As I say, there were members of the hierarchy, not that many in Argentina, but in Chile and other places who did denounce this repression and tried to intervene to stop it. No one has argued that Father Bergoglio did anything significant in terms of trying to take on this repression. He may indeed have spoken quietly to somebody behind the scenes, and maybe that did ultimately save the lives of these two priests, but it was rather much a sort of a retail approach to the problems, not one where he addressed the wholesale slaughter that was going on.
Robert, how important is it in your view that a full investigation takes place about the Argentinian Catholic Church involvement during the era of the Argentinian military dictatorship, and specifically Father Bergoglio, who is now Pope?
Well, I think it would be very important to have an investigation into these human rights crimes, and Argentina is doing better in sort of looking at some of these very painful examples. There was also the situation where women who were detained and who were pregnant were kept alive just long enough to have their children be delivered before the mothers were taken off to be executed and the children were farmed out to military families. So you had some very grotesque activities that were almost novel to Argentina. But the bigger investigation, in my view, should be, what was the United States' role during this time frame, particularly relating to George H.W. Bush, who was the CIA director in 1976 when much of this was starting, and then later when Ronald Reagan took office in 1981 and collaborated closely with the Argentines for the first couple of years before the Falkland War. And then you have the other big question, which is, what was the role of the Vatican? Pope John Paul II is widely regarded and beloved by many Americans, but his role in this time frame is quite sinister. So you have a lot that should be investigated, and the secrecy that still surrounds what happened in the Reagan administration, and even the greater secrecy that surrounds what happened in the Vatican, should be lifted. But one probably can't expect that to happen, Scott.
That was investigative journalist Robert Perry, editor with ConsortiumNews.com, and one of the reporters who helped expose the Iran-Contra scandal in the mid-1980s. He's the author of America's Stolen Narrative. Find links to Perry's columns and other articles on the Pope's conduct during Argentina's dirty war on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.